Ladies and gentlemen, we still have one or two seats on my right, and there may be, are there any seats in the middle here? All right, here are several in the middle, if you'd care to take those seats. If you prefer to stand, fine. I'll leave it up to you. We are reaching the conclusion of a marvelous alumni college, which began on Monday evening. The general theme has been freedom in America. The students at this college, and they are here today, of course, heard five excellent programs dealing with economic freedom, religious freedom, artistic freedom, personal freedom. Now, to give the concluding lecture on the general theme of freedom in America, and incidentally, dealing with freedom for all people in our great nation, and also to give the beginning talk for this year's Alumni Weekend, and what we see here is just part of the some 2,500 people we probably will have on campus tomorrow. Here to give this talk is one of our most distinguished graduates who has returned this year for his 25th reunion. And this, of course, is Vernon Jordan. His background is too well known to require much elaboration. Let me merely state he is internationally recognized as one of the great civil rights leaders of this world. He was the longtime head of the National Urban League. He now is a practicing attorney in Washington, D.C. Finally, we are especially proud he serves as a member of the DePaul University Board of Trustees, and as you will see in a moment, he also wears a tie like I have on. This is the school tie. Immediately following Vernon's talk, there will be a reception for him in the foyer immediately outside. I give you Vernon Jordan, DePaul University, 1957.
Thank you very much. President Rossa, members of the faculty, students, fellow alumni, those who had courage enough to come back to participate in the Alumni College, and especially my classmates in the class of 1957. I am delighted to be back after 25 years out in the world. Dick Ross made some comment about this tie. I went in the bookstore. I think you ought to buy something when you come back. And I went to the bookstore and saw this tie, and I bought it. And to my horror, it cost more than ties do in Brooks Brothers. But I wear it proudly, and I'm glad to know that inflation is here as it is in every place. As I stand here and look out at so many of you whom I've known for so long, I am reminded of a story told about a DePaul University student who was one of Dr. Compton's majors in philosophy, mind, and religion, who went on to Neil Fisher's Garrett Theological Seminary to get a Bachelor of Divinity degree and to begin his parish ministry. And the Bishop of Indiana called him to a small rural church in southern Indiana to begin his parish ministry. The young preacher with his new graduation suit on and the shirt that he'd gotten as a gift went to this small town, and that Saturday he went around and greeted all of the parishioners according to the church roll and said that he was a new pastor and tomorrow would be his first sermon. Sunday morning came and it was raining, and and it was hailing and it was thundering and it was lightning. The roads were not in the best of shape, but he was excited about the beginning of his parish ministry. And he went to Sunday school. Nobody showed up for Sunday school. At 11 o'clock, nobody had shown for church. About 11:20, one sole parishioner showed up for the church service. This anxious young minister rushed down to the farmer there and says, brother, I'm the new pastor here, and I have a problem. He said, at Garrett Seminary, they don't teach you what to do when only one person shows up for the church service. He said, do you have any suggestions? And the parishioner says, well, preacher, I ain't a preacher. I's a farmer. And all I know is that when I load up my wagon full of hay to go feed my cows, and only one cow shows up for the feeding, I feeds him. So the young minister took him at his word, went into the pulpit, sang the morning hymn, followed by the reading from the Old Testament, and then the New Testament, and then he sang a second morning hymn, followed by a 15-minute morning prayer, followed by the third morning hymn, followed by the altar call. And after the altar call, he preached a 45-minute sermon. And after the 45-minute sermon, he issued the invitation to discipleship. In the black church, we call that opening the doors of the church. But anyway, after issuing the invitation to discipleship, he took up the collection. And after taking up the collection, he wanted to welcome the visitors, but there were no visitors to welcome. And he made the announcements, and he said, this has been a great meeting, and I want to serve Holy Communion. So he served Holy Communion, and after Holy Communion, he wanted to sing, blessed be the tie that binds, and then the benediction. And when it was all over, he went down to the sole parishioner. He says, well, brother, how did I do on my first Sunday? And the brother looked up at him and said, well, preacher, I ain't a preacher, I was a farmer. And all I know is that when I load up my wagon full of hay to go feed my cows, and only one cow shows up for the feeding, I don't give him the whole damn load, he said. Now, that story has some applicability to those of you who've come to this final lecture, and that I want to assure you that I did not come here all the way from Washington, D.C. to talk for 2 minutes. I brought a whole load of paper, and I'm going to say every damn word. I will be talking today about some aspects of the broad subject assigned to me, freedom in America. And I suppose that my theme can be summed up by something written some 40 years ago by one of this state's most prominent sons, Wendell Willkie. He wrote, and I quote, "When we talk of freedom and opportunity for all nations, the marking paradoxes in our own society become so clear they can no longer be ignored. If we want to talk about freedom, we must mean freedom for others as well as ourselves, and we must mean freedom for everyone inside our frontiers as well as outside." End of quote. When Wendell Willkie wrote those words, Nazi prisoners of war were fed in southern restaurants that would not serve blacks, drank water from fountains that had signs with the words "white only" over them, and were transported in railroad trains that had separate sections for whites and blacks. Willkie and many other Americans recognized the paradox of fighting a world war against an avowedly racist nation in the name of freedom, and the ugly reality of our homegrown denials of freedom. That is a paradox rooted deep in American history, and the tension among differing notions of freedom continue to our own day. It was the genius of the men who founded our country that they proclaimed a radically new concept to a world that regarded kings, aristocrats, and hierarchies as the normal mode of organizing societies. That concept, embodied in our Declaration of Independence, states that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights. Among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It was those words and the promise they held forth that won America's independence, not the valiant and bitter military struggle alone. John Adams derided the idea that the Revolution was won on the battlefields when he said, "The Revolution was won in men's minds." And the core of that revolution, of the mind, was the promise of equality and the concept of democracy. The gap between the promise of the Declaration and the reality of America's imperfect democracy is especially seen in the conditions afflicting black people and other minorities. For a strong thread of hypocrisy runs through America's history, from the time a slave owner, Thomas Jefferson, penned the immortal words of the Declaration to our own time when the constitutional rights of black people are still incompletely realized. Freedom means different things to different people. Certainly, Jefferson could not have had the same meaning of freedom in his mind as one of the slaves on the Jefferson plantation had on his. Or perhaps Jefferson did, but as an ideal abstraction not applicable to the structure of the society in which he found himself. And I must wonder whether President Reagan has the same conception of freedom that is held by desperately poor people trying to survive in the midst of affluence and wealth. Certainly, the European immigrants who came to populate this land, to take advantages of its opportunities, to prosper, saw freedom in a vastly different way than the black population that was taken to this land in chains, forced to provide free labor, and ultimately relegated to second-class status. The Europeans came here to win freedom from political oppression, from religious persecution, from economic servitude. But black Americans found those evils here applicable only to themselves. Freedom was not an Anglo-Saxon invention planted in the New World by settlers who nurtured it. Freedom is a human longing found wherever men and women exist. The desire for freedom beat as strongly in the breast of black slaves as it did in their masters who declared independence from the King of England. It is often forgotten that the first revolt for freedom on this continent was not by white Englishmen in 1776, but by black Africans in 1526 in what is now South Carolina. Freedom has been the emanating dream of the black poor throughout our century, as it has been for white Americans and the Europeans who sought to become Americans. And yet, that freedom has either been denied or parceled out in small portions only to the black Americans who, more than any other people in this land, still believe in those ideals of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness that serve as our national goals and serve to taunt us with how far we have yet to go to fulfill them. So while the history of America is, in one sense, the story of freedom's triumph, it is also the story of freedom's failings, of the failure to share freedom's bounty and to include all Americans within its embrace. Thus, racial inequality and the quest for freedom have been the two dominant strains in America's history. The one frequently canceling out the other. Freedom for a large part of our country's history meant freedom for white people. The conflict between those two strains, led to a bloody civil war, after which the ideals of freedom were again compromised by the system of legal segregation. This university, our alma mater, has not been immune from the terrible tensions between race and freedom. Before 1946, its black students could not live in the dorms. When I came here in 1953, DePaul condoned segregated fraternities and sororities. I mention this not to condemn my alma mater, but to cite just one example of an institution devoted to truth and freedom that could not bring itself to extend those principles to black Americans. If anything, DePaul was typical of its day and time, just as it was typical of later times when it sanctioned an all-black house, thinking that was liberal and right, and as it is typical today in DePaul's serious effort to achieve a representative student body. If anything, DePaul was typical of the entire nation, which did not see the evils of segregation until the Brown decision brought the entire issue out of the shadows of custom and into the bright glare of constitutional mandates. It was then, in the 1950s, that the dictates of equality under the law finally took precedence over the traditional denial of equality for black citizens. Since then, we as a society have made enormous strides. Once our smug complacency was shattered by the sit-ins, the wait-ins, and the ride-ins, once the full import of the contradiction between political democracy and the denial of the basic right to vote sank in, once the absurdity of separate drinking fountains was emblazoned on the national conscience, change came. A series of executive orders, court rulings, and civil rights laws effectively wiped out the outward forms of segregation. Black people, newly liberated from the caste system, began to make extraordinary strides in politics and education and employment. Those gains were confined to those who were prepared to enter society's mainstream. But others did not have that preparation. They are still shackled by chains of poverty and disadvantage. They are the victims of history. As Lyndon Johnson put it just a few weeks before he died, and I quote him, "To be black in a white society is not to stand on level and equal ground. While the races may stand side by side, whites stand on history's mountain and blacks stand in history's hollow. Until we overcome unequal history, we cannot overcome unequal opportunity." End of quote. Lyndon Johnson was referring to the fact that political rights are not enough, that freedom to vote is a hollow right when your children are hungry, that freedom to sleep in the Greencastle Motel is no right at all if you can't pay the bill the next morning. And Johnson did not make that discovery himself. From the beginnings of time, human needs like food and shelter have been considered the preconditions of political freedom. Even in our own day, we can draw on countless examples of societies whose political freedoms crumbled under the pressure of economic crisis. That view is still not completely understood by all. There is a widespread feeling that purely formal rights are sufficient, and that society has no need to be concerned about the economic underpinnings of those rights. I agree with Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who said in the midst of an earlier depression, "We stand committed to the proposition that freedom is no half and half affair. If the average American is guaranteed equal opportunity in the polling place, he must have equal opportunity in the marketplace." I don't know how long we can tolerate 10 million plus people out of work without serious upheavals in our political system. I don't know how long we can tolerate a situation in which a tenth of the people supply 20% of the unemployed and 40% of the discouraged workers who have dropped out of the labor market. I don't think we can see problems of growing poverty, of fewer job opportunities, and deteriorating cities in isolation from our elementary freedoms. We cannot simply take it for granted that a system can survive so long as it fulfills people's basic constitutional rights without also meeting their human and economic rights to work, food, and shelter. Complacency is an American hallmark. We tolerated slavery while pretending we were a free country until the lie burst in a civil war. We tolerated segregation while pretending we were a free country until the lie burst in a decade of confrontation and compromise. Now we appear to be complacent about the prospects for the survival of our freedoms in the face of mounting poverty and anger, depression level, unemployment, and unequal opportunity. I am no doom and gloom prophet. I happen to think our institutions are flexible enough to meet the challenges of these extraordinary times. But I also know enough history to be concerned that we are polarizing in the worst way between those who care and those who don't care, and that freedom is too fragile to take for granted. That must bring me then to a discussion of some of the policies of President Reagan. I have met him, spoken with him, and I like him. I have a high personal regard for him. We visited each other in the hospital on similar occasions. The president is a good man, a courageous man, and on a personal level, a compassionate man. Not since Franklin Delano Roosevelt has America been led by so gifted a communicator. Not since Lyndon Johnson has it been led by so skillful a politician. But not since Herbert Hoover has it been led by a president willing to sacrifice millions of people on the altar of an outmoded ideology. The president claims to be bringing us new ideas and new policies, but they are actually a recycled version of the trickle-down economics and small government rhetoric Americans rejected 50 years ago, and with good reason. The president persists in clinging to the strange notion that the tax cut would lead to increased business investment, even though we are now operating at only 70% of capacity, even if demand is sluggish, and even if interest rates are far higher than any likely return on investment. On its own terms, in my view, Reaganism is an abject failure. It is shocking to see a conservative Republican administration saying budget deficits don't matter and projecting almost $500 billion worth of red ink over the next several years. It is shocking to see lifeline programs for the poor cut heavily while $1.5 trillion arms program is implemented. Instead of accountability finally being imposed on the Pentagon, we are creating a defense crisis by throwing money at the same people who brought us multi-million-dollar cost overruns and helicopter failures in the Iranian desert. The administration's failures are shared by its opponents. A Democratic-controlled House served as a compliant rubber stamp last year, and this year it has failed to present acceptable alternatives to the administration's plan. It is a measure of the approaching political crisis we face that we lack not only constructive leadership, but also constructive opposition. Democracy thrives through public debate of important issues, and through partisan advocacy of alternatives. Instead, we have contending slogans and rhetoric, but little in the way of educating the public to the real issues at stake. The Republicans have sown the seeds of economic distress and political rejection. The Democrats have convinced many people that a party that does not oppose is not fit to govern. The result is likely to be a chaotic political framework, just at a time when our nation faces serious decisions in both foreign and domestic policy. The erosion of political authority and public confidence in the major parties is not something anyone can see as a hopeful situation. We're entering a brave new world of rapid technological change, and the response of our leaders is to lay the groundwork for economic collapse. Japan, West Germany, and other countries are making giant strides in world markets we once dominated. More important, they are doing it in the industries of the future, the high technology industries that will spell national success or failure. And what are we doing? Instead of making the investments in human capital to build a trained workforce and a scientifically literate body of technicians and scientists, we are cutting education aid, closing skills training centers, and filling the tax code full of gimmicks that reward incompetence and encourage speculation. All of this from an administration and a Congress that claim you have to create incentives to get people to work. So incentives are created for the wealthy by cutting their taxes. At the same time, disincentives for the poor are created by measures that make it more rational for the working poor to quit low-paying jobs and become totally dependent. If this administration's economic record is a disgrace, its record on civil rights is in shambles. It undercuts the authority of the federal courts. It reopens old wounds about busing to desegregate unconstitutionally segregated schools. It fights affirmative action to the point of contemplating asking the Supreme Court to reconsider the Weber case. It supports right-wing causes that would put federal cops into our bedrooms and doctors' offices. Cornerstone of the administration's program is a new federalism that exports federal responsibilities to the states. I remember when the new federalism went by another name, states' rights, and it was used to justify segregation and abuses of constitutional guarantees. Today, it is just a code word describing an end to programs that help poor people. Some states will not keep those programs alive if they get control. I believe there is a meanness out there today we haven't seen in so long we've forgotten what real meanness is. It's a meanness that goes far beyond the usual differences of opinion in politics. This is no liberal versus conservative confrontation. The new radicalism is not only mean in actions, but in its rhetoric of widespread fraud and abuse. It is not enough to take survival programs away from the poorest of the poor, but the needy are also stigmatized as frauds and cheaters. That defrauds our political system and common decency. It debases political life in America. It polarizes where it should be seeking consensus. So while I like the president as a person, respect him as a man, and would greatly prefer that he prove me wrong by the success of his program, I must conclude, however, that Reaganism is a disaster for freedom in America, not just for poor people in America, but for all of us. For it threatens the fragile bonds of our society. It withdraws compassion from public life and substitutes a hard-hearted ideological rigidity that fails to speak to America's ideals. Rather, it speaks to America's traditional fears, fears of minorities, fear of equality, fear of a changing world. It elevates the worst in our heritage while stifling the best in our heritage. In the name of freedom, Reaganism endangers just freedom. But there is one saving grace in this administration's mean policies. And that saving grace is that its meanness is colorblind. It applies its meanness uniformly. It hits poor white people with the same force that it hits poor black people. Sadly, that may be our salvation. For so many white people in America who grumbled about those so-called black programs are being laid off today and finding that their unemployment benefits are cut, their families are not going to be able to get food stamps, and their local taxes are rising to replace lost federal aid. Those congressmen who were so happy to vote for welfare cuts are now getting letters from white constituents whose survival is in danger. Those middle-class white people who were so angry about black programs are now seeing white mothers telling newsmen about their kids losing school lunches and their husbands being laid off. All of a sudden in America, it is no longer black misery that is center stage, but a colorblind misery that's hitting many millions of white people. As Reaganomics victimizes white people too, as it threatens their economic security, as it robs them of hopes and expectations, I believe we will find new and unexpected resistance to it. For I see the seeds of a new coalition for fairness and decency being planted today, seeds that are nurtured in the harsh ground of unfairness and economic hard times. It's a coalition whose members are outraged by the unfairness of present policies. America has changed. People's minds have changed. What was once normal is now beyond the bounds of decency. Americans now know in their hearts that segregation and racism undermine national interest and the Constitution. They may not love busing, but they hate tax exemption for segregated academies. They may want to avoid further changes, but they will not tolerate a return to Jim Crow. Americans have accepted a higher level of decency in our relationships with each other. They look to their leadership to keep those standards high, to proclaim a vision of America consistent with our ideals. They know that, as the Urban League's new slogan puts it, everybody deserves